Here it is!
From deep inside your radio.
So, ladies and gentlemen, now the Democratic congressional leadership in the House of Representatives is advising Congressman Anthony Weiner not to ask for a brief absence while he seeks medical treatment or psychiatric treatment or the names of new Twitter followers, but to resign from the distinguished House of Representatives, where, you know, the ethics and the thing are above reproach. Just a sign of that is the one really close vote in Congress this year was the vote on the swipe fees. I know, probably ill-chosen name, don't you think, for PR purposes? The debit card swipe fee regulation proposed by the federal government to limit the amount that banks could charge retailers for servicing debit card transactions. You know, the card is swiped, hence the name. I think that's hence the name. I have to check on that. Anyway, as I say, that was probably the closest vote you're going to see in Congress this century. Possibly because it was the only issue where on one side you had arrayed powerful retailers such as Walmart, and on the other you had powerful banks. Both sides, therefore, willing to commit certain amounts of funds to persuasion of those in Congress who might vote this way or that way. That's the ethical status of the institution that's asking Anthony Weiner to resign. Not to defend him. I'm just saying, you know, pot, kettle, hey. And it's not just Congress. A sign of the ethical times. The recent FCC approval of the Comcast-NBC merger was preceded by a wave of letters to the FCC supporting the merger from nonprofit groups who had, in the recent past, you see, received charitable contributions from, oh my God, Comcast. This comes to mind because now AT&T, which wants to merge with everybody, no, sorry, wants to merge with T-Mobile, is using the same tactic, asking their partners in the nonprofit world to point out how much better the world would be for African Americans or Latinos if AT&T were allowed to merge with T-Mobile. That's just, you know, the ethical landscape we live in. One more sign, in the post-mortems or post-near-mortems over the implosion you read about this week of Newt Gingrich's presidential campaign, in which all of his top staff and many of his endorsers, a couple of his endorsers at least, have said, bye, Newt. The conventional wisdom in a lot of the, as I say, the post-near-mortems about why, you know, what happened, what went wrong in Newt's campaign. It's his month-long campaign for the presidency. Focused on, you know, not only his decision to go to take the 2-week cruise of the Greek islands at the behest of Callista. And yeah, what a surprise that, you know, a guy whose political career thus far had been dogged, so to speak, by his own dogginess in terms of the alacrity with which he shed the previous wife to court the next one. How ironic that the complaint should now be that the third wife has him on such a tight leash that he couldn't say no to the Greek island vacation that she insisted on. And that he had to take private planes, you know, from the campaign to get home at night. Yeah, really. But as I say, the conventional wisdom focused on another shortcoming in Newt's focus, his dedication, his commitment to do what it takes to run for president. That is to say, they all noted his unwillingness to get on the phone and call potential donors to raise money. Bad, Newt. Hello, welcome to the show.
The Indians send signals from the rocks above the pass. The cowboys take position in the bushes and the grass. The score is with the corporal, she is tied against a tree. She doesn't mind the language, it's the beating she don't need. She lets loose all the horses when the corporal is asleep. And he wakes to find the fire's dead and arrows in his axe. And Davy Crockett rides around and says it's cool for cats, it's cool for cats. The Sweeney's doing 90 cause they've got nowhere to go. They get a gang of villains in a shed up that he throw. They're counting out the fivers when the handcuffs lock again. In and out of Wandsworth with the numbers on their names. It's funny how the missus always looks a bleeding sane. And meanwhile at the station there's a couple of likely lads who swear like as your father and they're very cool for cats, they're cool for cats. To change the mood a little I've been posing down the pub. I'm seeing my reflection, I'm looking slightly rough. I fancy this, I fancy that, I wanna be so flash. I'll give a little muscle and I'll spend a little cash. But all I get is bitter and a nasty little rash. And by the time I'm sober, I've forgotten what I've had. And everybody tells me that it's cool to be a cat. Cool for cats. Onto the wall. I kiss her for the first time and then I take her home. I'm invited in for coffee and I give the dog a bone. She likes to go to discos but she's never on her own. I said I'll see you later and I'll give her some old chat. But it's not like they on the TV when it's cool for cats, it's cool for cats.
From London, England, quondam home of the empire whose dissolution created, I think, most of the world's trouble spots today. I'm Harry Shearer, welcoming you to this edition of Le Show. And now, because I think Addie has to get across the channel to a big meeting in France.
Yeah, I'm going to France. What of it?
No, they like you there, don't they?
They sure do.
Addie the Adam. News of our love affair with the Atom. A trove of U.S. diplomatic cables obtained by WikiLeaks provide colorful and sometimes scary commentary on the conditions in developing nations with nuclear power aspirations.
I can't wait.
In a cable from the U.S. Embassy in Hanoi in February 2007, concerns are raised about storing nuclear radioactive waste in Vietnam, which has very ambitious plans to build nuclear power plants. Le Dinh Tien, the Vice Minister of Science and Technology, is quoted as saying the country's track record of handling such waste was, quote, not so good, unquote, and its inventory of radioactive materials, quote, not adequate. Unquote. Even in India, which already has a well-developed nuclear industry and plans to build 58 more reactors, eyebrows are raised. The security at one nuclear facility visited by a U.S. delegation in November 2008 is described in a cable as moderate, with security officers performing bag and vehicle checks that weren't thorough, a lack of cameras in key areas, and some parts of the plant having very little security at all. If in a modern, stable democracy like Japan, there could be apparently lax regulatory oversight, failure of infrastructure, and a slow response to a crisis from authorities, it couldn't happen here. Then it begs the question of how others would handle a similar situation. Quote, if Japan can't cope with the implications of a disaster like this, says Andrew Neff, a senior energy analyst at market intelligence group IHS Global Insight, then in some ways I think it's a legitimate exercise to question whether other less developed countries could cope. Unquote. For many, rule number one for a safe nuclear program is a regulator with at least some semblance of independence from government or corporate influence. Critics worry that authoritarian governments will not tolerate an authority with even pretensions to partial independence or transparency of decision-making. While nuclear authorities in the West have also faced criticism for being too close to the industry they regulate, they're at least open to media scrutiny. But wait, there's more. The Japanese newspaper Asahi Shimbun has a series behind the looking behind the problems at Fuk. Quoting Sojiro Matsuura, president of the Nuclear Safety Research Association, workers for Tokyo Electric Power that operated Fuk, the Fuk plant, always seemed to be one step behind, as though they had not drawn up a worst-case scenario from the very beginning as they dealt with the series of events at that plant, from repeated hydrogen explosions at the core meltdown, blah, blah, blah. His predecessor as chairman of the Nuclear Safety Commission, Kazuo Sato, agreed, quote, the accident management implemented there was more concerned with form, unquote. Well, it does follow function, doesn't it? That's what I've always heard. TEPCO executives stressed that the tsunami that struck the nuclear plant was much higher than anyone expected. However, there were many experienced engineers there and in the government who clearly understood that a core meltdown would occur in a short period of time if all power sources were lost and the cooling system became inoperable. That's because about 20 years ago, Japan began promoting accident management, safety measures designed to respond to severe accidents at nuclear plants. That arose from safety research that sought to reduce the risks associated with nuclear power plants on the assumption that an accident will occur. Progress in that research involved a constant battle with the, quote, safety myth that claimed a major accident would never occur at a nuclear plant in Japan. Sato, who was former chairman of the Nuclear Safety Commission, says, in the 1970s, there was an atmosphere within business, bureaucratic, and academic circles that said, quote, don't say anything that will stimulate concerns among the general public, unquote. By 2002, electric power companies in Japan had installed accident management measures at all nuclear plants, including the installation of venting equipment. At the time, electric power industry officials boasted, quote, the probability of damage to a reactor core has decreased further from a one chance in about 10 million years. Look, we're making history. People 10 million years from now are going to look back and say, they had it. Dateline Tokyo, Japan admitted this week it was unprepared for that severe accident, like the tsunami-caused Fuk disaster. And it says damage to the reactors and radiation leakage were worse than it previously thought. This is in a report being submitted to the UN Nuclear Agency, the IAEA. The government also acknowledged reactor design inadequacies and a need for greater independence for the country's nuclear regulators. All right, we'll be working on that then. The report said nuclear fuel in three reactors likely melted through the inner containment vessels, not just the core. That's called, for those of you keeping track, a melt-through, not just a meltdown. A whole other preposition. The report compiled by Japan's Nuclear Emergency Task Force runs 750 pages. And it says, in light of the lessons learned from the accident, Japan has recognized that a fundamental revision of its nuclear safety preparedness and ready response is inevitable. It also recommended a national debate on nuclear power. The report calls the basic reactor design, the Mark I from GE, inadequate. That's inadequate imagination, I guess, including the venting system for the containment vessels and the location of spent fuel cooling pools high in the buildings. That resulted in leaks of radioactive water that hampered repair work. GE says 32 Mark I reactors operate to this day around the world. Japan's report also noted that the six-reactor Fuke plant paired up two reactors to share some facilities and equipment, which delayed the accident responses. The report said the vents lacked filtering capacity, causing contamination of the air, and the vent line interfered with connecting pipes. Experts have said the delay in venting was a primary cause of the hydrogen explosions that further damaged the reactors and spewed huge amounts of radiation into the air. The report said the outermost containment buildings also should have had vents to prevent a series of explosions. But that's just venting. Now, in this country, the Tennessee Valley Authority has filed an appeal asking federal regulators to reevaluate a serious safety violation they recently leveled against the Browns Ferry nuclear plant in Alabama, run by the TVA. Officials at the NRC announced last month they would give the plant an in-depth inspection. Wow! After deciding that a stuck valve on an emergency cooling system amounted to that rare red level finding, the most severe the agency gives to problems uncovered in its inspections. Only five such red findings have been issued since 2001. Fed regulators say the utility failed to quickly realize that a decades-old valve on one of two heat removal systems on Unit 1 had become stuck shut sometime after March 2009. Plant workers discovered the problem a year and a half later when they tried to use that system to shut down the reactor so it could be refueled. A spokesman for the TVA said the utility disputes criticism, contending the plant's testing program was inadequate. He said normal inspection procedures would not call for disassembling the valve and inspecting its interior for signs of failure. The utility blames a manufacturer's defect, says Golden, the spokesman for the TVA, quote, "You just assume it'll do its job," unquote. Doesn't that make you feel safer, ladies and gentlemen? They just assume it'll do its job. Let's all just assume it'll do its job, won't you? What do you say? It's Sunday. Let's assume. Ignoring the cliche. Dateline Tokyo, back to Fuke, the Japanese utility battling to bring those reactors under control, says more than 1,500 more tons, you see, of radioactive water are going to be moved into temporary storage. That's the latest attempt to prevent a massive spill of contaminated water into a little thing we call the environment. More than 100,000 tons of radioactive water have pooled beneath the Fuke plant. TEPCO acknowledges it made 1,000 errors in data submitted to the government to decide on power consumption goals for corporate customers. The wrong data are the latest embarrassment for the company. In a letter to TEPCO President Masakata Shimizu, the head of the Natural Resources and Energy Agency demanded correct information be submitted by Monday. The responsibility lies extremely heavy with your company for creating great confusion, he said. A design flaw in the exhaust system within the reactors at Fuke Plant Number 1 may have caused that hydrogen explosion. The same type of exhaust and venting system is installed at other nuclear plants in Japan, meaning a major review will likely be required at those plants. And again, back here, about 50 workers from the Hanford Nuclear Reservation. What, Addy, you're now like an Indian?
I know, tell me about it.
The Hanford Nuclear Reservation complained about health and safety issues at a meeting this week. The conference was organized by a watchdog group. Most who attended the meeting complained they aren't being compensated adequately for their health problems. They also said Hanford contractors and the federal government aren't keeping workers safe in places like the nuclear waste tank farms. Well, they're farms. What could possibly... I don't know that I'm scared to bring up things that are safety-related or anything, said a truck driver on the Hanford site, but I feel like I get labeled, or a lot of people that bring up safety issues get labeled as troublemakers. And so it makes you where you want to just keep your head down and go to work. It makes for an environment, if there's something really serious, you really don't want to bring it up. Unquote. Clean, cheap, too safe to meter. Let's all assume that we're keeping our heads down as we bid au revoir to Addie.
See you on the other side.
And now...
High def, low def, no def, take my hand. It's a digital wonderland.
News of the digital wonderland for you.
Got to be so careful where you stand in the digital wonderland.
Say, as if rising ticket prices and chattering patrons weren't enough, moviegoers in the Boston area are being left in the dark thanks to the regular misuse of the lenses on new digital projection equipment at many of the major theater chains. Almost no one at the theaters or their corporate headquarters is willing to talk about it, says the Boston Globe. The uniting factor is a fleet of 4K digital projectors made by Sony, rather the 3D lenses that many theater managers have made a practice of leaving on the projectors when they're playing a 2D film. Though the issue is widespread, affecting screenings at many chains, executives at all three chains and at the corporate offices of the projector's manufacturer have refused to directly acknowledge or comment on how and why it's happening. Apparently, there's a dimness that results. Dim and drainedness of color when the 3D lenses are left on the projectors when they show a 2D film. Says Dan Huerta, vice president of sight and sound for AMC, we don't really have any official or unofficial policy to not change the lens. The description of the problem comes from one of several Boston area projectionists who spoke anonymously to the Boston Globe due to concerns about his job. Fear strides rampant through the projection industry. He explains that for 3D showings, a special lens is installed in front of a Sony digital projector that rapidly alternates the two polarized images needed for the 3D effect to work. When you're running a 2D film, that polarization device has to be taken out of the image path. If they're not doing that, it's crazy because you've got a big polarizer that absorbs 50% of the light. Unquote. They're not swapping it out. And there's an easy way to tell. If you're in a theater playing a digital print, look back at the projection booth. If you see two beams of light, one stacked on top of the other, that's a Sony with the 3D lens still in place. If there's a single beam, it's either a Sony with the 3D lens removed or a different brand of digital projector. The difference can be extreme, says Chapin Cutler, a co-founder of a specialty projection company. He estimates that a film projected through a Sony with a 3D lens in place and other adjustments not made can be as much as 85% darker than a properly projected film. That's dark enough for director Peter Farrelly to complain loudly when his comedy Hall Pass had its promotional screening in a Boston theater prior to its opening this February. Farrelly went from one screening where the 3D lens had been removed to a second in which the lens was still on, and he couldn't believe his eyes. My stomach dropped, he said. It's one of the Farrelly brothers said that, ladies and gentlemen. He was sickened. Why aren't theater personnel simply removing the 3D lenses? The answer is that it takes time, it costs money, and it requires technical know-how above the level of the average multiplex employee. After multiple requests, Sony declined through its spokesman to respond to questions about its digital projection equipment. Executives at the chains are equally unwilling to discuss the matter. If they talk about it at all, the chains claim that individual multiplex managers are the ones to decide whether to switch out the lens. Yet some theater employees scoff at that notion. I could tell you who's not making the call, and it's not the managers, said one projectionist. He believes that unspoken AMC corporate policy is to keep 3D lenses on for 2D showings. If we knew a house would be opening Harry Potter and it wasn't going to be 3D, he said, I would ask them to swap the lens out and it would either go nowhere or come back with a negative from the regional technician, usually with the impression that it comes from above. The major chains, Regal, AMC, and National Amusement, signed contracts with Sony, the one manufacturer whose projectors feature the external 3D lens that needs to be swapped out for 2D movies. The reason appears to be a basic business quid pro quo. Sony provides projectors to the chains for free in exchange for the theaters dedicating part of their pre-show ads to Sony products. The 3D business took off in late 2009. Sony had to come up with a retrofitted solution. Says one Boston area veteran projectionist, I think audiences have to be a lot more proactive now because audiences are the only group that has any real concern for the quality of the image. They're the only ones watching it. Unquote. The digital wonderland, ladies and gentlemen, it beckons. Be proactive. Blink a lot more.
Lost you've got a busy life, a busy lifestyle, a busy lifestyle profile. Work, family, all you do to be you makes it hard to find the time to be a better you. Sure, an MBA degree would help you advance in your career, but even classes on weekends or evenings are difficult to fit into your hectic schedule. Still, that MBA degree would be nice. A problem that couldn't be solved until now. Announcing a breakthrough from the University of Tucson's Morpheus School of Business, the very first MBA program for giga-busy people like you. Now, for the first time, as far as our lawyers know, you can complete and master a full MBA course schedule while you're asleep. University teachers have known for years that students who sleep through their classes often score as high or higher on tests than those who didn't. Now, the University of Tucson has harnessed that insight to create an MBA program that actually makes you better, smarter, closer to your career goals as soon as you wake up each morning. Old-style sleep teaching depended on cumbersome tapes and temperamental machines. But the Morpheus program of the University of Tucson is powered by the same kind of software NASA uses to wake up its astronauts in space. Powerful sleep-sensing monitors know when you reach your deepest, most teachable slumber episodes. That's when your proprietary Morpheus receiver, or any internet-capable radio equipped with a Morpheus key, starts playing your lesson direct from the digital classroom. It's not customized learning. It's customated. Your colleagues will be impressed by your new confident demeanor, and so will potential employers on your ladder to the top. Confident? Of course, because you've fitted a full MBA degree education into what was until now the most unproductive part of your day. But don't take our word for it. Just listen to what we have to say. The Morpheus School of Business at the University of Tucson is ready to open the door of opportunity for you. Are you ready to sleepwalk through it? Log on to morpheusbiz.eu.ru and find out how easy it is to fit the Morpheus School of Business MBA program into your own personal wealth style. The Morpheus School of Business MBA program from the University of Tucson. Your path to being fast asleep.
Not a real university, no football team.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, tales of airport security. Two tales today. It's a two-tailer. First of all, Aaron writes, "Dear Harry, over Memorial Day weekend, my wife and I traveled from San Francisco to Los Angeles to attend a wedding. It was a wonderful trip, and I even had occasion to spend a few hours in Santa Monica for the first time. I have a deeper understanding of the nickname, Home of the Homeless, but I digress. I typically travel with a laptop computer. These items, as you probably know, must be removed from their cases and placed in a bin before proceeding through the screener. TSA agents at LAX made this quite clear as I waited in line. One agent emphasized repeatedly that laptops must be by themselves in the bin. And so it was that I made very sure to remove my laptop from its case and place it all alone in a bin. Moments later, when my turn came to proceed through the human screener, another agent asked if I had anything in my pockets. I said I did. She then directed me to remove these items and place them in the bin with my laptop. After adding my wallet, a stick of lip balm, a granola bar, and several loose ibuprofen tablets to the bin, I was asked if I was wearing a belt. I said I was. The belt joined the laptop and erstwhile pocket contents, all in that bin. Aaron concludes, Harry, I'm not a very technical guy, so I can only assume that the TSA knows its scanning devices well enough to stretch the definition of laptops being by themselves in the bin only so far. I wouldn't know. Aaron, I'm by myself in my bin. Then Phil writes, Dear Harry, as a listener of your show, I thought you might appreciate this. Last week, I was flying back to Europe from LAX after a few days over for business. While I was there, I bought a new laptop. All excited by my new toy, I was, of course, careful to remove it from my carry-on bag and place it through the scanner separately. You could say I was kind of obsessed about making sure I did it right. It was only after I was through security and at the gate I realized that I had taken the computer out of the bag, but I'd left my old laptop in the carry-on along with some liquids even. No one at security seemed to mind, or was it that they didn't notice? I will never notice, he adds, why laptops need to come out of the bag when things like iPads can stay in the bag. Babe, these days we're all in the bag. Tales of Airport Security, a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. And now, ladies and gentlemen, news of AFPAC. Yes, somebody wrote in and said, don't do the duck thing anymore. So this week only for you, news of AFPAC. David Headley is a bona fide insider in the tightly knit world of Islamist terrorism, and therefore of enormous interest to U.S. intelligence. This is from the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation. To avoid the death penalty, he cut a deal with U.S. federal prosecutors, did Mr. Headley. He would testify against his best friend, Tawahur Rana, on trial in Toronto, in exchange for telling the FBI everything he knew about the world of terrorism in Pakistan. So, in dramatic testimony, Headley has confirmed what the Indian government has long alleged and the government of Pakistan has long denied. The Lashkar-e-Taiba attackers, the terrorists who plotted the bombing in Mumbai, India, were trained, equipped, and bankrolled by Pakistan's military intelligence agency, the Directorate of ISI, and by extension, the Pakistani government. You've heard all about this in your new... Oh. Coming in the heels of the recent discovery that Osama bin Laden for years hid in plain sight near Pakistan's elite military academy, Headley's testimony has implications for Washington's shaky foreign policy relationship with its South Asian ally. The CIA has been concerned for years that Pakistan is playing a double game, claiming to fight terrorism in order to obtain billions in U.S. aid while at the same time supporting and providing a safe haven for the Taliban and al-Qaeda. A study done by the Institute of Conflict Management, a New Delhi-based think tank, alleges that at present there are 43 active terrorist groups, some such as inside South Asia, some such as Lashkar, receive support from the Pakistani military and members of the country's wealthy Islamist anti-American elite, and some do not. Since 9/11, the U.S. has given Pakistan $20 billion in military and foreign aid. The quid pro quo was supposed to be that Pakistan would fight terrorism. Headley's testimony to the Pakistani military intelligence was behind the Mumbai attacks buttressed criticism, that is, from members of the U.S. Congress, that Pakistan is playing a double game. It also underlines a concern voiced by Canadian and American intelligence experts that young radicalized Muslim men from the West are trickling into remote militant training camps in Pakistan's frontier provinces to learn terrorist tradecraft and will someday return to put their training to use at home. Congressmen on both sides of the House aisle, according to a congressional study paper, are questioning the wisdom of existing U.S. foreign assistance programs being given to a nation that may not have the intention and or capacity to be an effective U.S. partner. Even so, the study concludes the U.S. cannot afford to throw its apparently double-dealing ally under the bus. If it did, China or perhaps Iran might be happy to step in and be Pakistan's new best friend. News of AFPAC, ladies and gentlemen. Even scarier without the duck noise.
Why are the coolest customers in the Antarctic so hot? Got to be extra access tonight for early June. everyone. I'm Mike DeVere.
And I'm Pat Mungo, back from rehab again.
Not since Willie the Penguin marched across millions of packs of cool cigarettes 60 years ago have penguins been making such a cool splash in pop culture. By now, there are probably more of the cute frosty birds in movie theaters than in the whole country of Antarctica. Starting with March of the Penguins, then Happy Feet, the parade of penguins continues this week. And if there's an animator in Hollywood who doesn't know how to make penguins lovable by now, he never will. But why this craze for a bird that barely makes a peep? Someone's making major noise on the penguin's behalf.
I'm Maddie Schulkraut. I'm a partner in Bankable, a boutique talent agency in Beverly Hills adjacent. And I think I'm the first agent in the business. Well, I know I'm the first agent to own the rights to and represent of an entire species, the penguin. The penguin came under my wing, so to speak, about 5 years ago, given its charm and its potential to be serious camera candy. I just thought it was an underperforming asset. So I made a few calls.
In this Extra Access Tonight exclusive peek at an upcoming video news release, we learned that the World Zoologic Federation made Maddie the penguin's rep after his impressive presentation at ZooCon 2004. His first step was a two-week deep think about the bird's name.
I met with branding experts, the people who came up with the name Chilean sea bass for the, toothfish? Kiwi fruit for whatever that thing was called. And we brainstormed about new names that could give the penguin the same kind of sizzle, only more so and bigger. Some of the ones we generated, Arctic Snowbird, which doesn't really work because the thing basically lives on ice. I mean, I didn't, you know. But Ice Parrot, which just sounded to me like $1 billion. But anyway, bottom line, we all felt penguin, the name, was already like a cute word, you know, that told you without you even knowing it that this was a cuddly, lovable, merchandise, buyable kind of bird. So we stuck with penguin. And we saved a ton on the renaming.
Then we asked Marty's personal publicist to ask him what happened next.
Well, I started making the rounds of the studios and the serious indies, just doing my pitch, you know, at the everybody's headed up to here with mice and rabbits and friggin' dinosaurs. What's going to be the next cool species?
We took a meeting with Maddie, then we took a lunch. And then we decided to take a dinner.
Reaction Pictures head of production, Dominic DiPietro.
He had basically invested in focus grouping this bird, which, you know, seemed pretty peculiar at the time, I have to say, until you looked at the numbers, at which point, hello. We greenlit Meet the Penguins. We had a change of management, so that became Meet the Fockers, but I knew that wouldn't stop Maddie.
Of course, you gotta keep it fresh. That's the only way you protect the franchise. CAA's got puffins now. And they're nosing around some big deals. Theme park deals. So for next summer, we're pitching Penguin Mania, about a penguin rock band at the Tours Alaska. We're pretty convinced that it's a puffin killer.
Maddie Schulkraut, the man who put the heat under the penguins without cooking them. That's it for tonight. But Inside Extra Access Tonight comes rolling back tomorrow. Till then, I'm Mike DeVere.
And I'm Pat Mungo. So long from Culver City.
Last night, I had a dream. You were in it, and I was in it with you. Never one that I know, never one that you know was in my dream. I saw a vampire, saw a ghost, and everybody scared me, but you scared me the most. In the dream I had last night, night in my dream. Started out in the barnyard at sundown, and everyone was laughing. You were lying on the ground. You said, "Honey, can you tell me what your name is? Honey, can you tell me what your name is?" I said, "You know what my name is." Last night I had a dream. You were in it and I was in it with you. Never wanted I know, never wanted you know it was in my dream. I saw a vampire, saw a ghost, and everybody scared me. You scared me the most. In the dream I had last night, in the dream I had last night, in my dream.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, the apologies of the week.
We're so sorry.
Dateline Belgrade, Serbia. Two decades after its reporting helped fuel the worst bloodshed in Europe since World War II, Serbia's state-run television has apologized to viewers throughout the former Yugoslavia for serving as the key propaganda tool of the late autocratic leader Slobodan Milosevic in the 1990s. Imagine that, a TV network apologizing. Think of it. Radio Television of Serbia said in a statement posted on its website that the station's program was, quote, almost constantly and heavily abused, unquote, by Milosevic's regime, with the aid of discrediting his political and ethnic opponents and spreading official propaganda. The broadcaster, quote, apologizes to the citizens of Serbia and those of neighboring countries who were subject to insult, slander, and what would now be termed hate speech, unquote. The apology is the first by Serbia's state broadcaster. But speaking of broadcasters and media organizations, News of the World, a British tabloid newspaper owned by Rupert Murdoch, this week issued a detailed formal apology for phone hacking for the first time to actor Sienna Miller, a lawyer for News Group Newspapers, read a statement in high court expressing regret for intercepting voicemail messages intended for Miller. His client, News Corp, offers, quote, sincere apologies, unquote, to Miller for, quote, the distress caused to her by accessing of her voicemail messages, the publication of the private information, and the related harassment she suffered as a consequence, unquote. The attorney added that News Group, quote, acknowledges that the information should never have been obtained in the manner it was, the private information should never have been published, and that this defendant has accepted responsibility for misuse of private information, breach of confidence, and harassment. Miller accepted an out-of-court payment of £100,000. I wonder if News International can afford that. Delta Airlines is apologizing to 34 U.S. Army troops who just returned from Afghanistan because they had to pay some $2,800 in baggage fees. One soldier says, not happy at all. We had a little issue with the bags. Most of the GIs had four bags. Delta only allows three for free and coach, and anything over free bags you have to pay for. Even though it's a contract between the U.S. government and Delta. By the way, just for those listeners who are wondering, and I know at least one, no, Horizon has not yet returned my baggage fee for the flight that they never completed for me. But it's Horizon. In an appearance on the Adam Carolla online show this week, stand-up comic and former sitcom star Christopher Titus sparked outrage by joking that if Sarah Palin became president, he would, quote, hang out on the grassy knoll all the time, just loaded and ready. Titus later apologized via Facebook to the Kennedy family and Miss Palin's family and asked for people to stop the death threats. Facebook has apologized over how its new photo tagging function was rolled out, acknowledging that more should have been done to inform members about the global launch. Quote, we should have been more clear with people during the rollout process when this became available to them, they said in a statement. Tag suggestions are now available in most countries and we'll post further updates on our blog over time. Using facial recognition, The feature is able to match pictures that are uploaded to existing friends and offer suggestions to the user to tag these, blah, blah, blah. Just don't trust it. Don't do it. University of Texas at El Paso basketball player John Bohannon apologized on his Twitter account this week for an alleged anti-gay tweet he sent Monday. His original tweet appeared to be in response to NBA players Grant Hill and Jared Dudley and their participation in the NBA's Think Before You Speak campaign. They appear in a national television commercial denouncing using the word gay in negative terms. On Monday, Bohannon tweeted, "It is not cool to be gay." Jordan shrugged. Thursday afternoon, Bohannon followed with, "To those who were offended by my tweet a few days ago, didn't mean any disrespect by it, as I do not judge anybody by their sexual preference, and would hope you would not judge me by one tweet. Thank you." You're welcome. Speaking of basketball players, Oklahoma City Thunder guard Nate Robinson apologized to fans after the police caught him urinating in public in White Plains, New York. The White Plains police said an officer spotted Robinson urinating on a sidewalk just before 2 a.m. Friday. The offense normally carries a $50 fine. Robinson posted a message on Twitter saying he made a silly mistake. What, he thought it was 3 in the morning? Tracy Morgan has come under fire from gay groups and human rights organizations for a reportedly homophobic rant during a stand-up set in Nashville earlier this month. An audience member tells the gay right group Truth Wins Out that Morgan said in an extremely profane manner that if his son were gay, he would kill him, that gay kids who were bullied need to man up, and that being gay is a choice and something that kids have been learning from the media and programming. His rep initially had no comment, but then Morgan issued a statement Friday afternoon apologizing, saying the bit went too far and was not funny in any context. You know about the homeowners who have foreclosed on the Bank of America down in Florida for trying to foreclose on them even though they didn't have a mortgage. Bank of America spokeswoman emailed a statement saying, "We are very sorry for our errors and the resulting experience Mr. Nair just had with Bank of America. He's been fully paid the amount we owed. While the matter is now resolved, we are embarrassed by this chain of events and the trouble this has caused him. We will improve our process to prevent these errors in the future." Bank of Apology. The Apologies of the Week, ladies and gentlemen, a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. And now, ladies and gentlemen, news of the Olympic movement. London 2012 organizers have been left with red faces, says The Guardian, over their green promises coming under fire from the watchdog that monitors their sustainability claims after they've admitted defeat. Defeat in a bid to make these Olympic flames for these Olympic Games the first low-carbon version. Unveiling the design of the Olympic torch to be carried by 8,000 runners, Chairman Lord Coe admitted the sponsor, EDF, had failed to come up with a workable low-carbon solution for the flame that will travel Britain from May and light the Olympic cauldron on July 27th. In simple terms, we didn't quite get there. It's not work that's wasted. It'll be transferable for future thinking about Rio and Sochi. We just ran out of time and we tried very hard to do it, he said. Instead, the torch will use a tried and tested formula of butane and propane. In November 2007, amid a welter of other promises attached to the Games, EDF promised to develop the first low-carbon torch as a symbol of its commitment to green energy. The spokesman for the French energy company vowed at the time, "It's early days, but it will happen." That's the spirit, because it didn't. By the way, ladies and gentlemen, the Olympic torch, invented for the 1936 Berlin Olympics, reputedly brainstorm of Adolf Hitler himself. What could be greener? The relay has an immovable deadline, and both London and EDF concluded there would not be enough time for all the required testing. The chairman of the Commission for a Sustainable London said it was disappointing. It's the agony of defeat, which is a part of the Olympics, a movement, and we all need one. every day. Ladies and gentlemen, just one piece of news from outside the bubble. You know that FIFA, the international organization that supervises world football, that is to say soccer, has been beset by charges of bribery and corruption. Their new president, Sepp Blatter, who's got a free pass to the Olympics, was reelected this week because he was unopposed, because his only rival pulled out in the last minute amid charges of bribery. So who's on call to come clean up FIFA? Henry Kissinger. Newly reelected FIFA president Blatter says Kissinger agreed to join a committee of wise persons to help investigate problems within the organization. I bet he suggests bombing it. Ladies and gentlemen, by the way, Newt, call me. I'll give you money for your campaign. It's been good for the show. That's going to conclude, ladies and gentlemen, this week's edition of Le Show. The program returns next week at the same time over these same stations over NPR worldwide throughout Europe, the USN 440 cable system in Japan, around the world through the facilities of the American Forces Network up and down the east coast of North America via the shortwave giant WBCQ, the planet, 7.415 megahertz shortwave, on the mighty 104 in Berlin, around the world via the internet at two different locations, live and archived whenever you want it, harryshearer.com and kcrw.com. Available for your smartphone through Stitcher.com and available as a free podcast at kcrw.com. And it'd be just like Newt going away for another cruise if you'd agree to join with me then, would you? All righty, thank you very much. Tip of the show, chapeau to the San Diego, Pittsburgh, Hawaii, and Chicago desks. Thanks, as always, to Pam Halstead. The email address and the playlist of the music heard here on, always available at harryshearer.com. The Big Uneasy, plan right now in Chicago, Peoria, Chapel Hill, coming soon to your burg. Details at thebiguneasy.com. And this program is on Twitter at The Harry Shearer. The show comes to you from Century Progress Productions and originates through the facilities of KCRW Santa Monica, a community recognized around the world as the home of the homeless.